Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. If you can get to the Deadwood Mountain Grand tonight, you can be among the first to see the new SDPB documentary. It is called Deadwood Pioneer, A Face from the Past. There's a special screening tonight, May 16th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time. Panel discussion and Q&A follows. Join the friends of SDPB for that. Tonight, the event is free. And we're going to talk a little bit about Deadwood Pioneer, A Face from the Past with Dr. Tom David. He is a forensic dentist, and he joins us now from the SDPB studios in Rapid City. Dr. David, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you.
Such a fascinating field, forensic dentistry, and I'm just dying to know how you end up getting involved in that as part of your career.
Well, when I was a fourth-year dental student, it was offered as an elective in the last semester of my dental education, and I was curious about it, so I took the elective, and during the time that I was taking that elective, there was a plane crash in the Atlanta area. And the person who taught the course asked some of the students if they would be willing to help in identifying the victims of the plane crash. And that's what seeded my interest. And then I didn't do anything with it for several years until 5 years later. I eventually went to the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington, D.C., and took additional training in forensic dentistry, or as it's known in the technical world, forensic odontology. And the rest is history, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
Give me an idea, just some of the specifics about how you identify someone from, the remains of a plane crash. What do you need to have, and how do you match it all up?
Well, obviously, if you're going to use dental records to identify someone, you need to have records to compare with the people that you're trying to identify. And so usually, like in a plane crash, they would start with a manifest of the passengers on the plane, and they would contact next of kin to try to get dental records. And the individuals who die in the crash have examinations done that record what their teeth looked like, x-rays of those teeth, and then we compare those with the antemortem or the records of those people in life to see if there is a match of those records.
Go ahead. How hard is it to be certain?
In most cases, it isn't. Teeth are the hardest structures in the body. Enamel, what's on the outside of your teeth, is the second hardest substance in nature. Only diamonds are harder in terms of natural substances. And so teeth survive a lot of violent encounters, including fires and things of that nature. So because of their extreme durability, they're often very valuable in trying to conduct investigations to identify people who have died in any number of encounters.
Hmm. The rewards of doing this kind of work, how does it sort of play out as you find success, but yet, also have to share some very bad news with people?
Well, despite the fact that there may be bad news at the end, the fact of the matter is many individuals want closure. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems that you see in missing persons investigations, when they never recover the remains of that individual and don't even know if they're dead, in fact, is the fact that it just kind of hangs there in the air and there's never any closure. So oftentimes, even though the final message isn't good news, the fact of the matter is that they get closure, and many individuals have some sense of peace from that amount of closure.
Let's talk about the documentary Deadwood Pioneer and then transition that concept of closure to that. What was so interesting to you about these remains that were uncovered in Deadwood when you first got involved with the project?
I had never been involved in a case of archaeological remains. Even though I've done so many other cases in my career, this is actually the first time I've ever been involved in an examination and investigation of archaeological remains. And I think one of the things that piqued the interest of those who wanted this type of examination was that even they sensed, without dental training, that there was something unusual about this individual in terms of their dental findings. For instance, this individual was only missing two permanent teeth. And in the mid to later 19th century, oftentimes if you had a toothache, they just removed the tooth. And so for an individual from that era to only be missing two permanent teeth is rather unusual. And then, of course, what was even more unusual than that was the fact that of the 10 teeth that were restored, four of them had gold foil restorations, which were very expensive, very technique sensitive, and they just weren't done very commonly at all. And so the immediate connection in my mind when I saw that was that this individual probably came from some means in order to be able to afford that type of dentistry. But more than that, he had to have found someone who was capable of doing that quality of work.
Right.
So it was kind of an intriguing start.
So tell me what the state of dentistry is at this time. Put that into context.
In terms of what? In terms
of
restorative treatment?
Right. Are there no dentists? Is it experimental at this point? What are the dentists learning in school or in apprenticeships at this time?
Oh, okay. Well, you're talking about the 19th century.
Right.
Yes. The first actual dental school wasn't founded until 1840. That was the Baltimore College of Dental Surgery, and ultimately it became the University of Maryland. And interestingly, the National Dental History Museum is in that building. But they only taught exodontia, which is the removal of teeth. There were several other schools founded after 1840. There were two schools in Philadelphia. One of them became Temple University, and one became the University of Pennsylvania. But it wasn't until 1867, when Harvard opened, that there was a dental program that was part of an academic institution, and they taught restorative dentistry. So prior to that time, anyone who became a dentist learned by virtue of an apprenticeship. And so if you studied under someone who wasn't very good with their hands, the chances were pretty good that you would probably end up falling into that same category. Mm-hmm. So we know that this individual who did the dental work for the Deadwood Pioneer early in his life probably was very accomplished with his hands. And even though it's unlikely he was formally trained, the fact of the matter is he probably trained under someone who was very good. Mm-hmm. And so my initial suspicion was that this individual probably had the work that included the gold foils done somewhere in the East, although he had later dental work done that wasn't of nearly the high quality that this was.
Interesting. So the gold foil doesn't come from South Dakota.
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, I mean, we're talking about a gold rush and all kinds of things.
Oh, no,
this isn't. This is totally unrelated to the kind of work he would have had done. What does a gold foil restoration look like at that time?
Well, a gold foil restoration, obviously, as the name implies, the restorative material is gold. And the way it was produced, there would be microscopically thin layers of gold that you would put in sequence into the cavity preparation, and you had to pound them, if you will, into place. And it was very, very important that that area stay dry, whereas the regular amalgam or silver filling, you could put it in a pool of water and it wouldn't matter. But with a gold foil restoration, if there was any moisture, it wouldn't stay in. And so for someone to have had four gold foil restorations in that time period that survived until these remains were discovered in 2012 tells you the quality of the work that was done.
Did dentists practice on each other? Did they practice on apprentices? Is there any indication that the Deadwood Pioneer could have been in the field somehow?
Not to my knowledge.
So probably a person of means, probably had his work done on the East Coast. And then, you know, so there's a different sort of work that he has done later on. Tell me about that.
Well, other things that we discovered in looking at his teeth beyond simply the restorative treatment was that he had fluorosis staining, also known colloquially as Colorado brown stain. Unlike the fluoride that is put into water to reduce dental decay, It is naturally occurring in certain parts of the United States. And because if the levels are too high, what will happen is you will get intrinsic staining in the teeth that is brown, and it's not removable, unlike tobacco stain or wine or coffee. It's incorporated into the tooth. Those parts of the tooth will be very resistant to decay, but it's not very aesthetically pleasing to see teeth with these brown spots all over them. So we know that this individual later moved to the fluorosis belt, which is West Texas, Eastern New Mexico, Western Kansas and Nebraska, Colorado, and a portion of Wyoming. But interestingly, it does not include the Dakota Territory. So the presumption was that this individual grew up in the East, moved somewhere in the fluorosis belt, and later ended up in Deadwood.
What else can you tell? Can you tell about diet? Can you tell, you know, what else is possible when you look at the records that you had access to for the Deadwood Pioneer?
Well, in addition to the things we already discussed, there were two other things that were of note. Number one was there was a small anomaly on one of the lower front teeth that's referred to as a Turner's tooth after Dr. Turner, who named it. But essentially, if a tooth is injured while it's forming, but before it erupts into the mouth, you will get an interruption in that part of the development of the tooth. And it can be chemical, it can be an infection, it can be physical, although in this case it was only on one part of one tooth, and so it's unlikely that it was an infection because that would have affected all of the teeth that were developing at that time. So it's more likely that this was actually a physical blow to that area early in that person's life, because the tooth in question doesn't erupt until around 6 years of age. So that injury probably occurred before the age of six.
Can you speak, Dr. David, to sort of the process of this research that so many people were a part of? I mean, we're talking about the documentary. If you're just tuning in, Deadwood Pioneer, Face from the Past, you can see a special screening tonight at 7 Mountain Time at the Deadwood Mountain Grand. Dr. Tom David is my guest, forensic odontology for more than 33 years. Can you speak to the process overall and the collaboration between different archaeologists and scientists and, historians?
Yes, I'm really impressed by the array of forensic scientists that were brought on board to look at various aspects of the investigation into this person's background. There was a forensic anthropologist that looked at the remains before I did my examination. So they gave some information about the individual's probable race, height, sex, things of that nature. And there were other individuals that conducted DNA analyses, a whole variety of things. My understanding when I was interviewed for the documentary was that in speaking to Katie Lamy, she indicated that the report that I provided after my analysis dovetailed very nicely into a lot of the other findings of other forensic experts in this case.
Katie Lamy is the South Dakota State Archaeologist, if you didn't know that. And Dr. Tom David, Clinical Assistant Professor at the University of Tennessee Graduate School of Medicine. He's a member of the American Society of Forensic Odontology and a fellow of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. Thank you so much, Dr. David, for being here with us today.
Thank you.
And he will be part of a special panel discussion and Q&A, and that is after the special screening of Deadwood Pioneer, A Face from the Past. You can meet him and others tonight, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, Deadwood Mountain Grand. The premiere on SDPB-TV of the documentary is Monday, May 22nd, 8 p.m. Mountain Time.